Thank you for the invitation. It's a great honor to speak here at the Freud Museum in London. First time we talk in like something in London. Well, we should start off by confessing that we don't have the same approach to Wagner, Karin and me. Whereas I am a Wagner skepticist, Karin is a Wagner enthusiast. So naturally, we differ in our attitude towards Parsifal. We do agree in our way of reflecting about music, though. We both think that psychoanalytical analysis of art should not, as it is used to do, take the artist's biography as the only approach for understanding music. But we also have to look at the complex cultural situation. As a starting point for our investigation of Wagner's Parsifal, I would like to begin with describing a personal situation that might have some significance concerning my feelings to Wagner. When last year my wife and I visited the Festspielhaus in Bayreuth for the first time, we were very excited, dressed up the best as possible, and full of pleasant anticipation. Bit difficult for me. Suddenly, we encountered a specific obstacle when realizing that I had forgotten to take the tickets, which was no problem. We came in nevertheless. But, of course, I started to reflect about the what was at the bottom of this Freudian slip. What was the cause for the reserve concerning one of the greatest composers in German music? Why, to put it more generally, does this composer and his art not only in me provoke such divergent feelings? To solve this riddle, let me start by posing the fundamental and very general question. How can we describe the nature of a work of art? So our approach is to step a little back and start a reflection about how art works. It's clear that a piece of art is an aesthetical object. The word aesthetical refers to the Greek word of aesthesis, perception. A piece of art, thus, is an object in which perception dominates the psychic process and reacts to it. So one thing we can say about music is that it is an object in an aesthetical feel directed towards our perception. Music can be described as the art of organizing a chain of acoustical perceptions in a way that seduces us to turn our attention to this chain of perceptions. The specific chain of perceptions called music is so seductive that we allow it to enter into the deepest and best protected areas of our subjective life. We allow it to affect our emotional and bodily self and to touch and move our core identity. We open our heart to the message of music and are willing to temporarily enter into close fusion with this sounding world where no interpretation or rationality stands between the experiencing person and the work of art. Looking further, we can certainly agree to that music is in many ways opposed to language. We have one semantic system to create meaning, which is language, and we have a second semantic system to create, which is aesthetics, that is a way of dealing with perceptions, organizing perceptions. When I was looking for a name for this second semantic system, which doesn't need any words, I wanted a name to cover both sides of the process. On the one side, the chain of aesthetical perceptions. On the other side, the emotional and bodily self that enters into a deep and intense synchronization with the aesthetical perceptions. So I have ended up calling the nonverbal semantic system of music kinesthetical. Aesthetical because it refers to a highly organized chain of perceptions, and kinetic because of the nature of the subjective structures involved. We respond to music not through our reflexive ego capacities, but through our bodily kinetic subjectivity. So, I propose the verbal lexical semantics of language from the kinesthetic semantics of music. Of course, this distinction is related to the well-known distinction made in psychoanalysis between verbal and pre-verbal structures. So what I do with my theory is to investigate the mechanisms of the pre-verbal world. Ladies and gentlemen, let's take a step back and describe the rules or mechanism of the aesthetical world in a little greater detail. I will ask you for a little more patience. We come back to Parseval, but we need a little return. How can we describe the specific rules of organizations we find in the kinesthetic semantic field? They are very different from what from the rules and mechanisms we find in language. I think we can describe these rules by three core mechanisms, which are, firstly, repetition of form, secondly, seduction, and thirdly, ritualization. The first principle is very easy to explain. It's clear that in music we find the repetition of form on every level of organization. The rhythm of music is a steady or irregular repetition of an acoustical event in time. The fugue as a form is organized by a single theme. The inattention of a sonata results from the fact that two themes are different, of different character, are opposed, and this opposition is repeated and developed. Wagner is famous for the invention of a specific form of repetition and variation, namely the leitmotif, which gives an emotional and scenic orientation in the floating world of his operas. It's clear, however, that repetition alone does not describe what happens in art. In art, we expect to be surprised as well as to find what we know and like. We expect the creation of new forms, the creation of new aspects. The mechanisms at the basis of this effect are called seduction. Seduction means that art is set up a rule of repetition and to break this rule in the second step. You can see this in the sonata, where we have the two themes, which kind of form the rules. And in the development, these rules are transgressed. Wagner, of course, is a master of seduction. Again and again, he sets up a horizon of expectation, or harmonic expectation, and then transgresses it. This is how art works. It sets up a rule and seduces us into a movement that transgresses limits drawn till then and thereby transforms our inner world. But, as I try to show later on, Wagner himself is not always loyal to this law of art. I think that in art, in the art of Wagner, we find a paradox. Although he's very seductive, and his artist's core intention is conservative. I'm only speaking about Parseval. I believe that, after all, Wagner serves repetition and its aims more than seduction and its aims. I'm sure this aspect has to be discussed very carefully. Let us not jump into conclusions prematurely. Besides the repetition of form and seduction, there is this third aspect of the kinesthetic semantics, which I call ritualization. I think in a Wagnerian context, this is very easy to understand. What do I mean by this term? In music, we find not only the basic mechanisms to produce a meaning, but also larger units that the effect of that organize the perceptual process. A song, for example, consists of the stanzas and the chorus. This is a ritualized form of most songs. Other ritualizations of the form are the sonata or the fugue, or the classic opera has also a ritualized form. These ritualized forms organize larger units of time. They guarantee that the relation between the experiencing subject, the kinetic subject, and the bodily self and the work of art can grow and deepen. This is important because the synchronization between these two sides of the kinesthetic process needs time. When given, a strong bonding between the aesthetic object and the kinetic subject can be established. This process can be disturbed by manufacturers. It is a well-known fact that the unusual length of Wagner's operas contributes to the polarization of the auditory. I mentioned before, one part gets bored and the other parts develops a very strong and enthusiastic bond towards this oeuvre. Of course, ritualization is a very general concept which plays a part in a religious field and in the field of art. We find ritualizations everywhere from football to certain narrative forms like the daily detective stories we watch in TV. Ritualization is powerful when it comes to organizing the emotional world of subjective life. But rituals can serve different aims. If you compare the function of ritualization in these different fields, we come to a decisive distinction. In religious and many other social rituals, the aim is not to create something new, but to reaffirm and to assert the structure of the group. A person attending a religious ritual does not expect to be surprised, but wants to be reassured and feel part of a group. Thus, religious rituals are dominated by repetition, whereas ritualization in art is dominated by the other mechanism, by the mechanism of seduction. And the aim is to surprise, to puzzle, to disturb, and to enhance psychic growth. This difference can be seen most clearly in the themes of mortality and sexual conflicts. Religion denigrates mortality by promising eternal life after death, whereas art tries to get along with the unattractive fact of mortality. Religion tries to solve sexual conflicts by inscribing a hierarchical male domination into the sexual relation, whereas art describes sexual conflicts, loss, infidelity, rivalry as they are, and hereby encourages us to deal with these aspects of human life. It's impossible here to outline the essence of my aesthetical theory in full length, but I hope that these aspects I have mentioned so far in reference to the basic mechanisms as well as to the ethical core of art will suffice to form a suitable background for our investigation of Wagner's Parsifal which the composer himself has clad into the religious nature of a divine service. He wanted a divine stage service to be performed only at Bayreuth, his personal Jerusalem. He forbid applause, and he used lilac ink in the composition. This is a traditional church color for the Holy Friday. And last but not least, created the myth that he first conceived Parsifal on Holy Friday. Karin Noah will now take over and take a closer look at the opera, and after that we shall shortly try to discuss the questions in which respect the nature of Wagner's last opera can be called conservative or innovative. And here you will see that we make slightly different aspects.
So we're going to have a super Bergian change here. Only who is who? sorry about this, but I must read from my laptop because I kept changing around the text and changing around and shortening. So sorry about this.
But still something left.
Yes, I hope so. Is it okay? Okay, I plunge into a Parsifal. In Parsifal, music and stage action at first sight speak very different languages, as many authors have noted. And if you remember Eva Rieger, remember her on her paper, she said, "Well, really, I don't know about the text, but the music." Yeah. So this is what many people say. Usually, the music is given the preference over the stage action, most notably by Nietzsche, the intimate Wagner adorer and his sharpest critic. He confessed himself to be in awe of the music, but he hated and ridiculed the libretto that for him showed nothing but Wagner's over-adaptation to his wife's Catholicism, out of the feeling of guilt for a passion to another woman at the time when he wrote Parsifal. This is what Nietzsche says. On the other hand, Thomas Mann, in contrast to most other critics, spoke admiringly of the drama Parsifal as an oratory of redemption, and found the dramatic action the most convincing of all of Wagner's stage plays, because without any digression, everything is focused on the main theme. Thomas Mann, as you will probably know, was very familiar. He never missed any Wagner opera wherever he was, and he could sing all roles. He was a famous... Wagner was extremely important for him and his development as a writer. Seeing such significant Wagner experts disagree, let us therefore listen to the words of Giuseppe Sinopoli, the famous conductor. In his book on Parsifal, he elaborates the contrast stated above by pointing out that the music, with the important exception of Act II, seemingly stands still. Adorno calls it static, and could, with its subtle variation and intertwining of the recurring leitmotifs, be viewed as an eternal wheel. This is something an expression somebody else used before here today. Whereas the dramatic action stretches out like an eternal path, moving on and on. But after having conducted Parsifal in his hometown, Venice, once, Sinopoli changes his mind. He lets himself get lost that evening in the labyrinthic streets, musing musical ideas. After hours of nightly wandering, he comes up with a sudden insight that Parsifal's way, just like his own, is a circular one. It does stretch out, but in an elliptic sort of way. He takes a close look at the stage directions in Parsifal and finds out that Wagner first moves Parsifal from west to north into the Grail district. After leaving the temple, when failing to ask the decisive question, Parsifal turns south to Klingsor's paradise-like garden and castle, and finally he moves eastwards and upwards to reach the Grail temple district again. Eastwards and upwards, in our tradition, has always been the trail to wisdom. Sinopoli sees the protagonist on a path of initiation, which, geographically speaking, circles around the mountain Mont Salva, the name indicating the opera's main theme of salvation. Following these findings, we have reasons to assume that Wagner conceived Parsifal's development as a circular, endless process. In Nietzsche's sense, werde, der du bist, become who you are. But Parsifal, who at the end becomes the king of the Order of the Holy Grail, is not through with his development. That's my opinion. The last famous words of the opera, Redemption for the Redeemer, indicate this mysteriously and clearly at the same time. The Savior remains in need of salvation himself. Personal development may come to a standstill, but not to an end. Looked at it from this angle, it can be said that the action does stand in accordance with the music and its eternal wheel character, demonstrating Wagner's conception of a never-ending human development. You only find the text boring with Adorno, boring, the text, or even ridiculous, Nietzsche, if you do not detect the what I would call basic human scene lying underneath the Christian surface. In my opinion, Wagner and Parsifal makes exactly the same use of Christian rites and symbols as he does with Nordic mythology in The Ring. The Grail and the sword, dwarfs, giants, and worms all find place in a colored window through which the shapes of central basic human conflicts can be discovered. Blurred, but can be discovered. Wagner himself, in his theoretical text, calls this process mystification, mystification. I'd like to remind you that he did not see himself as an opera composer, but as a creator of myths. Already starting with Tannhäuser, he shrank away from the word opera for his works. To quote Thomas Mann again, Wagner, in his view, is neither a poet nor a composer, because neither text nor music can convince on its own account. Mann sees him as the Dionysus of the theater. I wonder if this is in accordance with Nietzsche's famous sentence of Wagner being God's ventriloquist. Some personal remarks that seem like a digression, but well. It took me many labyrinthic years to find access to Parsifal and Wagner music in general, and what helped me find it were my grandfather and psychoanalysis. Sometimes, as a child, I heard my grandfather sing along with a baritone Schlussnot. But it struck me later on that his love for Wagner music was something like a secret affair, like a love affair. My grandmother was never present when the two of us sort of vanished in their beautifully polished Grundig apparatus like Tannhäuser in the Venusberg. Something about this scene told me that listening to Wagner was not quite kosher. When I was about 11, I read my way through my grandfather's bookshelves, and what caught my attention was a modern prose version of Wolfram's book, and especially the passage when young Parsifal saw knights riding through the woods in which he had grown up with his mother. What an apparition. I found it a very suitable conclusion that Parsifal thought this was godlike. In fact, he thought they must be God, of whom, in my opinion, Herzeleide, his mother, spoke as perpetually as my own. today, as my own mother. Today I think that this scene has burned itself into my memory because my first encounters with art had something of this sudden apparition too. Art, in its surprising, striking, and unforgettable images, showed me a way out of a childhood that was shadowed by the repressed or unspoken of guilt and bewilderment of what my parents had gone through as well as committed in the Second World War. They were Herzeleiders, and as children, we did not understand why. So it will not come as a surprise to you that my first Parsifal at Bayreuth in 1969 was a disappointment. No knights. Instead, the stage was crowded with bizarre monks. Then there was Gurnemanz with his boring, lengthy explanations, and only one woman in the whole play that, just like the Blumenmädchen, did not even succeed in seducing the hero, and no money for the Würstchen in the break. So as you see, I was not ready for the opera at that time. This, of course, had to do with the fact that I was still very much under my mother's influence, who only revered Bach, whereas for Wagner and Liszt and even Brahms, she felt nothing but contempt. It seems noteworthy that she was not against Wagner out of political reasons, an attitude I later found common among the politically correct people of my generation, who felt it not in accordance with their attitudes to listen to the music of an anti-Semite, and identified Wagner with his descendants. Only until I became a psychoanalyst could I finally fully open up to Wagner, who in his development from traditional Rienzi to his last work, Parsifal, became a master of showing the working of the unconscious in men, in the Holländer focusing on the narcissistic need to live on someone else's life, in Tannhäuser on splitting, in Lohengrin on identification and identity, in The Ring on practically all central human inner scenes, and in Meistersinger on the development of creativity. And in Parsifal, so we come back to this opera. In Parsifal, we witness the apotheosis of guilt and pity. Empathy, midlight, cannot really be translated. It's really more than pity and compassion and empathy. To quote Sinopoli again, salvation is the main theme of all of Wagner's operas. In Parsifal, however, it is the main theme. Wagner, who freely and boldly arranges, shortens, and amplifies Wolfram's text, tears down the terribly lengthy narration he finds, that's what he calls it, and focuses all on man's need for salvation from guilt through compassion. The first act exposes the theme of pity and its opposite, contempt. We have not spoken about this in various ways. The very beginning, the spectators witness the pain Amfortas suffers. We have seen many, well, the film and so on. He is being carried on stage, exhausted from a night of agony. They hear him sigh. Nothing but Kunri's palm can lessen the pain. In addition, the spectator is invited to feel the desperation of Gurnemanz, who deplores the fate of his king, and through him learns about all the reasons behind it. So it goes without saying that the wound is a sign of guilt as well as of self-punishment, a double function we so often encounter when treating psychosomatic patients. Like Prometheus and other famous sinners, Amfortas must wait for being redeemed instead of healed. Directly after this expository scene, Parsifal appears shooting the swan, symbolizing life and innocence. In Nordic mythology, which Wagner was intimately acquainted with, two swans live among the roots of the world tree Yggdrasil, die Weltesche Yggdrasil, symbol of growth and development. Totally unaware that he's doing something wrong, Parsifal presents himself proud of his marksmanship. But as soon as Gurnemanz points out to him the suffering of the animal, very beautifully sung and done in the film too, the suffering of the swan, tears fill Parsifal's eyes in the stage direction. He wipes his eyes. And throwing his bow away, he shows his determination never to repeat such a deed. With the help of this little scene, not only Gurnemanz is easily convinced here comes the savior. This young man is without worldly wisdom, and he is capable of spontaneous compassion. Who else could fit it better? Only a minute later, Parsifal is thrown into despair when hearing from Kunri that his mother died. "You killed her by leaving her," is Kunri's laconic message to Parsifal, thus drawing him into the group of guilty sinners. Shocked, Parsifal must be drawn back by Gurnemanz so as not to strike the messenger of these devastating news. He freezes, trembles, his mouth is dry. Wagner, in the stage directions, reveals typical signs of a traumatic reaction. You must remember that the mother is the only person he had in his life so far. Well, traumatic reaction to which Kunri behaves passionately, compassionately, giving him water, whereas Gurnemanz prefers to teach Parsifal to behave like a man and to divert him from his feelings. Eager to lead the savior to the grail ceremony, Gurnemanz denies the young man compassion, thus denying him exactly what he expects from him. Gurnemanz's feelings are with Amfortas and not with Parsifal. In fact, he takes advantage of Parsifal's situation of loss and guilt. The young man, in his state of shock, has no will of his own left and gives himself up to a seemingly fatherly leader who accompanies him into a bizarre ceremony, confronting him with a terribly severed father figure. No wonder that Parsifal keeps quiet, and no wonder that Gurnemanz, whose emphatic feelings are solely directed towards Amfortas, finally rudely kicks Parsifal out of the temple district with a contemptuous remark. No pity, no mitleid here for a parentless youth in a state of total bewilderment. What is empathy? From Farnaghi and others, we have been taught how we learn it and under which circumstances we fail in it. Wagner's favorite fairy tale was Grimm's story about a man who went out to learn how to feel fear. I don't really know how the translation is in English. Der Mann, der ausging, das Fürchten zu lernen. Nothing whatsoever terrible could move this man until he married. And his wife one night suddenly poured a bucket of ice-cold water over him while he was sleeping. Coldness by the beloved one, as we know, is something to be feared. And if experienced often, it can hamper the development of empathy and further what Barland calls primary guilt, the guilt of being alive. Parsifal, who has grown up as his mother's narcissistic object, having to keep her alive after the loss of her husband, is psychologically not very well equipped for feeling empathy, neither for himself nor for others. It was Wagner's sensational idea, some years before the talking cue was invented, that after confronting the audience with Parsifal's, as well as Amfortas, seemingly unsolvable problems in the first act, that he shapes Parsifal's encounter with Kunri in the middle act like a therapeutical session. Kunri is one of Wagner's most complicated roles. We talked about it, a mixture of many images filled to the brim with a feeling of primary guilt in the Barland sense of the word, shame, self-punishment. Her godlike calling Parsifal by his name to draw him away from narcissistic flirts with the flower maidens, a moment you'd never forget in your life when it is sung well, is an act of creation, of offering him to become an individual with an identity of his own. This is what we do in our therapies, calling our patients by their real names again and again. Just like us, Kundry is familiar with Parsifal's biography better than he himself is. In particular, she makes use of Parsifal's dependency on the but good early mother to invite him to a new sort of love. In this, we see Wagner intuitively showing the ubiquity of transference. At first, Kundry succeeds. Parsifal is attracted to her and deeply moved. The boy, who has to this moment been frozen in shock, comes to life and to enlightenment. Transference love has been established. Kundry, alas, has not had the benefits of being treated herself. Deeply traumatized in many ways, she's so much under the spell of her own needs that she cannot but misuse Parsifal's feelings, betraying him while pretending to be authentic. This is the coldness Parsifal feels and from which she on sudden impulse draws back, an act made only possible through the identification with the father, with Amfortas. This drawback and change of sides, however, cannot be seen as a scene of triangulation, because it is linked with a self-sacrifice. The former mother's son now becomes a father's son in a pre-Oedipal sort of way. He moves forward, yes, it is a change, yes, but he moves onto another level of the same, in an order of men excluding women and degrading them to objects of salvation. To sum up, Parsifal's development, like that of his predecessors, Darland, Tannhäuser, Lohengrin, Siegfried, Tristan, and even Wotan, is incomplete. His development comes to a standstill. In his last work, Parsifal, we are confronted with Wagner's search for a remedy for guilt and stagnation that was discovered in Vienna only a couple of years later. Now we'll start a sort of dialogue.
Yes, thank you, Karin. Ich glaube, ich mache as we have heard in very many of the presentations, is this precise moment of the kiss between Kundry and Parsifal, in which we can witness what Karin called the collapse of the interpersonal therapeutic situation. She showed that the fear of the archaic and mighty mother leads to a development of a self-protection from women through a close contact with a group of men. The result is an asexual male identity, since the homoerotical order of the Grail, women are equated with sexuality and denied a personal of their own. Sacrificing their own sexuality and degrading women to only sexual beings, a development to a mature identity becomes impossible. So, when becoming king, Parsifal remains a boy who is fascinated by the group of knights. Parsifal stays on this line, and we do not witness psychic growth, but a psychic change lying within a circular process. Thus, the collapse we see in the encounter between Kundry and Parsifal is the failure of a developmental process in direction of a mature male identity, which includes the capacity to overcome archaic fears concerning women, to deal with sexual conflicts and enjoy a mature heterosexual or homosexual relationship. At first sight, this only concerns the action on stage. But how do these findings, based on the analysis of the dramatic action, relate to the musical structure? As I said first, we have to relate those two levels, And for the first level, for the music, we have developed categories. We can point out two aspects. What can we say briefly about this very complex texture is that we all perceive a clear and fundamental difference in the musical atmosphere between the three acts. In the second act, which is the encounter of Parsifal with a woman, not only with Kundry, but also with a maiden in Klingsor's magic garden, the music is vivid, expressive, and highly dramatic in the Parsifal-Kundry encounter. It forms a container for intense emotions of various qualities, emotions of tenderness, rage, seduction, fear, love, and hate. Whereas in the first and third act, the music shows a very different emotional atmosphere. I personally would like to describe it as slow, sticky, sometimes boring, and dominated by repetition. To me, it smells like inhibition. It is an atmosphere which I experience as a prison. I know, however, that other listeners go into a close fusion with this atmosphere.
Yes, I personally would describe qualities of inwardness, concentration, harmony, patience, religious immersion, or contemplation.
But both of us perceive a substantial difference in the musical and emotional atmosphere of Acts 2 and 3 and the middle one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To quote Adorno again, Act 2 and 3 are static in character. Act 2 is dramatic.
Let us now look at a special detail. Stefan Mahnkopf, a brilliant German musicologist, shows in his analysis of Parsifal how Wagner builds the basic musical structure of his work of art. He draws the attention to the fact that some of Wagner's masterpieces are rooted in one specific interval that dominates both the melodic and harmonic structure of the piece. In Tristan, with its famous harmonic transgressions, everything originates in the specific interval of the second. A second is experienced as a dissonant interval appropriate to create psychic tension and appropriate to evoke emotions of pain and conflict in the auditor's bodily cells. You perceive a friction, a bodily friction by perceiving this interval. In Parsifal, as Mahnkopf points out, in many examples, everything originates from another interval, from the third. The third is in contrast to the second, the interval of harmony. The two notes forming the interval melt into each other and unite easily. Mahnkopf points out that especially in the first and third act, the harmonic structure is dominated by harmonic steps that avoid tension and proceed in a harmonic way. Wagner does not use the strong tension between the dominant and the tonic, which is characterized by the dissonant interval of a second, but uses chord progressions formed by the progression of the subdominant tonic, which is much more gentle and harmonic. To quote Mahnkopf, the end of Parsifal is an apotheosis of the subdominant, a potentiation of the plagal harmony. That's the word for it. Quotation end. Plagal harmony is an expression for chord progressions formed by the relation subdominant tonic. Plagal harmony is often used in religious context, and it's not by chance that the plagal harmony cadence is called the Amen cadence. This is from Wikipedia, so this is not very special a Mahnkopf, but this is very common under musicians. So we can see that the artistic aim of creating a religious and harmonic atmosphere in the first and third act is very deliberately and consequently pursued by Wagner. In fact, we can find it in every detail of the composition. In using plagal harmony, Wagner also creates new harmonic progressions, but they all do not leave this atmosphere of harmony. They seem impressionistic, and indeed they have been picked up only many years later by Debussy and Ravel. Ladies and gentlemen, I try to show that music stimulates the embodiment of the emotional signification of the verbal symbols. Music envelops our body, our bodily emotional self, and vividly throws the emotional message into the central aspects of our psychic lives.
But of course, how we respond, which feelings are evoked, cannot be determined by music only. Our personality, our cultural background, the mood, the inward and outward situation we are in when listening to work like Parsifal are responsible for the immense variety of different reactions and judgments. So let us at the end of this paper present our personal attitudes towards this piece of art, which, as Sebastian and I agree, presents Wagner's desire for personal development and his quest for broadening one's identity, and also confronts us with the tragic failure of this project.
To me, the collapse of the Kundry-Parsifal relationship brings about and equals the collapse of the aesthetical space. The turning point, as we have seen the kiss, Kundry and Parsifal, is the moment from which on we witness that the aesthetic orientation is replaced by a religious orientation for redemption. Redemption wins over the wish to mature and of overcoming conflicts. To me, the breakdown of the aesthetic dimension is grounded on the view that Wagner idealized this victory. The result of the is defense and repression, and it speaks out in an atmosphere without conflicts and a space of harmony. It is not very lively, but it seems safe. The person or the group is redeemed from conflict tension. Nowhere do we find regret towards the fact that psychic growth and loving sexuality, fulfillment, relationship, be it homosexual or heterosexual, stays impossible for Parsifal. On the contrary, we must witness how women are devaluated and excluded, whereas the homoerotical group of knights is idealized. Only symbolically, the aim of a mature sexual relationship is hinted at. The central ritual of the opera, a spear and a goblet, the grail, are finally reunited. So in my view, redemption can psychoanalytically be described as the idealization of a defense process. In Freudian terms, als ein primärer Krankheitsgewinn, a primary gain from illness. We all love peace and harmony. We all search for places where we are protected from conflicts. But concerning art and concerning psychoanalysis, to endeavors that spring from the same source, we cannot follow this love for harmony. If we do so, we betray the ethical core of this endeavor. I do consent with Cioran when he says, ein Dichter, der nach Erlösung strebte, beginge Verrat an sich selbst. A poet who would seek for redemption would betray himself. You can feel a very strong ethical engagement in the lines of Cioran. In the two, wie heißt das nochmal? Du hast doch was geändert. Den zwei, in the Irrealis, poetry, who would seek for redemption would betray himself. They show that Ciaran vividly presumes that no poet would ever follow this line.
Okay, I agree that the religious concept of salvation may imply the sacrifice of autonomy and personal growth. Still, I disagree with your idea, with Sebastian, of Wagner being a conservative who gives up the ethical aim of art. Therapeutically speaking, or thinking, we know that development is a dynamic process of steps forward and backward, of daring something and shrinking from it, of resistance, Widerstand, and overcoming resistance with the help of the psychoanalyst, of ego destabilization and conflicts, and stabilization of the self in harmonic phases, of fusing with the seemingly only good aspects of the psychoanalyst, in changing from the harmonic static parts of the opera to the dramatic parts. Wagner, in my opinion, mirrors exactly this dynamic process. Idealization is, in fact, a mighty defense mechanism, but it is also the most mighty factor in development, as Janine Chasky-Smirgel has pointed out in her analysis of the ego ideal. Wagner shows us both aspects. Idealizing the nights in the woods, Parsifal is able to leave his mother and his childhood. In idealizing the Order of the Grail, he defends himself against destabilization in the Kunri relationship that he cannot cope in any other way with. No regret is shown on stage, yes, but in the audience, tears are shed because Wagner confronts us with the fact that in each life, progress comes to a standstill, sometimes earlier, sometimes later. We are not the all-round mature persons we would like to be. We are confronted with our unsolved problems of guilt and desire, as well as with our insufficiency in coping with it. As long as a piece of art evokes discussion and engaged debate, it cannot lose its ethical aim. Parsifal is not a divine service. It only assumes the shape of one for purely aesthetic purposes. We do not leave this opera strengthened by divine nutrition, but deeply concerned with the state of our own developmental stages and problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen and Sebastian. Is this one? Thank you, Karen and Sebastian, for a really sort of personal and sort of bringing those two themes of music and psychoanalysis together, which really was the whole point of this conference initially. So it's a really lovely way to tie things off. You know, we had the challenge to psychoanalysis. It wasn't the first title we thought of. We were thinking of something like Parsifal and the Freudian Quest or something like that, weren't we? And whether that's a successful thing. So really, I mean, in your paper, I think you've, both from your own different positions, have really asked that question of whether Parsifal as an opera relates to and succeeds in perhaps a psychoanalytic quest or whether perhaps it fails. So, I mean, we certainly have some time for questions. So if anyone would like to ask a question of either Karen or Sebastian, or both indeed, then please do feel free. And this is the music.
Just a very general question. Have you ever taken this particular opera east to India, China, anywhere like that, to see the response that
Excuse me, I didn't quite understand you.
Please use the microphone.
Oh, right. Instead of seeing this in a Western context, where I imagine it would be much easier to understand, even if still a bit difficult, has it ever I'm just asking from a point of ignorance, has it ever been taken to India or China or anywhere east and presented to an audience?
Oh, sure enough.
It has.
I don't know if you followed in the papers, if you read in the papers about a couple, 4 years ago, that a ring production from Cologne was sent to Peking. And they produced the complete ring there, and they were confronted with different obstacles. For example, the custom couldn't imagine what these things were, these props and so on. And there were different obstacles. But the Chinese audience was perfectly prepared. They all had read the text, and there was no problem. My daughter is a violinist, and there are practically 80% in her class are from Korea or Japan, or they all come to Germany to study music. That's the way it is, and they are they go to the opera. They love Wagner. So this is just very informally speaking, but this is what I know.
Tom,
just pass you the mic.
Yeah. You spoke of the overall form of Parsifal as circular, and talked about the compass directions, north, south, east, west. Mm. My own view of the architecture of the of Parsifal is a little different, not a mutually exclusive. But I see Parsifal as a triptych, like an altarpiece, with the Act One and Act Three as the wings, and Act Two as the center panel of this triptych. And I wonder if you've noticed that in the transformation scene in Act One and Act Three, Wagner's stage directions say the action moves in Act One from left to right. Mm-hmm. And in Act Three, his stage directions say exactly like in Act One, except from right to left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there we have the... Mm-hmm. Well, you could say that was circular. As I say, my view of the architecture is not necessarily mutually exclusive with yours, but I see it more as a kind of a triptych altarpiece kind of form.
Which doesn't speak against the religious architecture.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Yeah. I think it goes very well along. It's a beautiful picture. It goes along with your idea. Yeah. Mm. Yes.
Thank you. I like very much the idea of kinesthetics that you were talking about. You also made me think when I'm trying to give my daughters good advice and they point to my own vices, I say, well, I can't be a good example, but I can be a cautionary tale. And it seems that that's how you divide, that one of you sees Parsifal as a good example and one sees him as a cautionary tale. But however you see him, do you agree that you're seeing words, the libretto, as holding the conscious material and the music as holding the unconscious, what is unbearable? Because that's what it sounded like to me, what you were describing, but I don't know if you can say more about that.
That's what I said. I know this theory, but mine is a bit different. I view it more, if you read a text, there are a conscious and unconscious levels. And I don't think that the musical structures are semantically different, but they very often, and surely Wagner was a genius in this, translate the message into bodily perceivable emotions. Yesterday when I saw the film, I was very touched by the description of Kundry, of her the relation of Herzelei to her son, and there is a little son, and there is it's very clear that there is the emotion. The music has the function to transport the emotion into the bodily self, and what my work is to investigate the mechanisms, how that works. I didn't have very much time to expose that. I'm doing nothing but differentiating at one term of the Freud oeuvre. For him, the bodily side is sublimation, and the aesthetic coming uniting with this is called the Vorlust mechanism. I don't know what the English word is. The pre-Vorlust mechanism.
Vorlust mechanism.
Vorpleasure.
Vorpleasure mechanisms.
Yeah, just thinking exactly. Yeah. Thing
in jokes. Okay. Yeah. Same thing in jokes. Exactly. And what I investigate is how do they work, these mechanisms. That's the aesthetical world has a structure, and we can investigate it.
Maybe I could add that Sebastian's theory has developed in a couple of years, starting out with investigation the Orpheus myth, and it's really difficult to present this, you know, in one paper. So this just maybe give you an idea, maybe if you're interested to read his books, if you can speak German. But
there's an article of mine coming forth in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, and I don't know when it comes, but it will come someday.
Could I ask that, you know, as psychoanalysts, you are in the therapeutic business. You want to heal your very disturbed patients. Does music play a part in this? I mean, would you ever recommend to one of your patients that they should listen to Parsifal or Tristan and help them?
Yes, I do. Let me explain a little more general how I view the psychoanalysis and art. I have asked myself, where does psychoanalysis come from? Does it come from religion? No. Does it come from science? Not really. Does it come from philosophy? Yes, a bit. But it's only art, in my view, that is really interested in a single person and gives all the attention to a single fate or a single situation, right? And in your paper about the presentations of the two operas, you said a very similar thing, that you do evaluate the presentations where the director gives very much doesn't answer questions but puts up questions and goes very into the specific details, and that's what art does when it's and that is what a psychoanalysis does. So I think we are the inheritance of art.
But you haven't answered my question.
No. Yes.
Well, okay, I will answer it.
Music.
Patrick, I will answer it, okay?
and I agree.
Okay. If I talked with my patients about Parsifal, this would be counter resistance.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't do this, usually. There's one patient I do it with. But what I do is I listen to the music of their voices, and this I do very attentively. And I sometimes say to my patients, I don't respond maybe, and they go on telling things and so on. And then I suddenly say, you know what? What you've just said, you've said it in a completely different tone. Now let's try and understand this. What's behind this? So psychoanalysis is like a duet, really. It's chamber music. Yeah, it's very important. It's not only the words that you listen to. Yeah, it's the music of a personality, really, and of your own personality responding to this.
Mm. Sure, but that's you, you know, being the musician and responding to the sounds of the voice, which I can understand, but you still haven't answered my question about whether you might actually have a patient one day and said, look, I'd like you to listen to the third act of Parsifal. I think that would help you.
That might be something that a CBT therapist would do, I suppose. You know, get to, you can, but a psychoanalyst wouldn't do that.
Yes, but we do. I thought Karin would talk about that, this aspect. We do encourage our patients to engage in their aesthetic endeavors. If they go acting, we encourage this because we think it's a field of personal growth. Or if they begin to learn a piano or guitar or whatever, this is a field of development.
It's okay. So you would think that indeed that people need art in order to perish of their lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm always very interested in what their specific and personal artistic world is. What do you listen to? What do you? If this is a kind of music, I absolutely don't know. I do ask them to bring their music, and I do listen to their music.
I mean, I think that's kind of a really key point, isn't it? I mean, that the you know it should really almost come the other way. You know, it's not the analyst who's there to give advice over what you should listen to tap into the human condition. You know, it's really, you know, the analysand, the patient, where, you know, the desire of the analysand has to be sort of recognized. And so, you know, it could be anything. It might not be the third act of Parsifal, but like Karin was saying, the tone of the voice, the musical chain, you know, so music comes into the dialogue, but also, as you were saying, Sebastian, the actual music itself, you know, the physical form of the music should spark from the other direction, I guess, you know, rather than, you know.
Absolutely.
I think, any more comments? I don't know, Ivan, if you want to say anything at the end. Okay. Any more? Just, one last question,
I'm not sure that this follows on, but there's been a great deal of talk about sexuality, and I was just interested in what Jung thinks of Amfortas, because he sees him as being gripped by a sort of compulsive sexuality, and that's what causes the problem. And if I may, and it's partly in response to having listened to you both, I'd love to just read a passage where Jung is talking about Amfortas. If, in the case of Amfortas and the union of spear and grail, only the sexual problem is discerned, we get entangled in an insoluble contradiction, since the thing that harms is also the thing that heals. Such a paradox is true and permissible only when one sees the opposites as united on the higher plane, when one understands that it is not a question of sexuality, either in this form or that, but purely a question of the attitude by which every activity, including the sexual, is regulated. Once again, I must emphasize that the practical problem in analytical psychology lies deeper than sexuality and its repression. The latter point of view is no doubt very valuable in explaining the infantile and therefore morbid part of the psyche. But as an explanatory principle for the whole of the psyche, it is quite inadequate. What lies behind sexuality or the power instinct is the attitude to sexuality or to power. And I did want to bring in that attitude to it, because it seems to me to be an ethical stance.
No, that's okay. That's fine. Thank you for reading it out.
For his own kind of description of the Oedipus complex, because he never wrote a paper about it, he just sums it up by saying, it's the emotional attitudes a child has to his parents and siblings.
Yes.
And so attitude is emotional attitude,
yes.
and it brings in all lots of other stuff as
well. Oh, yes,
well,
I can really see that.
No, well, I mean, I think in the spirit of asking questions rather than answering them, we should probably leave it there for the day. So I'd like to just thank Karin and Sebastian for their very thought-provoking paper. And indeed to all our speakers who have given up their time very generously to come and speak here and entertain us all day. So.
And
finally to the audience who've been so generous.
And to Thomas Ivan.
I hope to see you at the Floyd Museum soon.